and you're on the front porch, where we tackle tough issues facing Appalachia like you and your friends do on your front porch. With the budget fights in West Virginia and nationally, we thought it'd be a good time to talk about talking with each other. What does social science teach us about how to change someone's mind? The Front Porch is sponsored by the Charleston Gazette-Mail, using its CGM app to deliver the latest news, traffic, and weather alerts. Download the CGM app at iTunes or Google Play. Joining me, as always, is conservative lawyer and columnist Lori Lynn. Hey, Lori.
Hi, Scott.
And we're going to take advantage of Lori's lawyering skills today, talking about persuasion, since that's something that lawyers tend to do. And West Virginia's answer to Bruce Lee, our liberal, Greek-loving, hillbilly philosophizing American Friends Service Committee working co-host, Rick Wilson. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Scott.
All right, this week we're talking about persuasion. Newsflash, it's harder than you might think. You know, I love this podcast and segment that NPR does called Hidden Brain. One of the things I've learned from that is why it's so hard to change people's minds. And one thing is that stress and trauma leads to groups turning inward and people kind of narrowing their options.
Right. And some friends of mine have come up with this sort of idea of a tension triangle, where the horizontal part of the triangle represents the options you see. And as you go up the point of the triangle, that represents tension. So the more tension you're under, you tend to see fewer options.
It's like tunnel vision, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
And it seems like that's kind of, Lori, what's happening with the legislature right now. The House, the Senate, the different factions seem to be just like digging in deeper instead of coming to some sort of consensus.
Yeah, well, the source of the tension in this case is time, right? The clock is ticking, and as we get closer and closer to mid-June or July, the consequences of not coming to an agreement get harsher.
I always think you got to try to talk your cat down off the tree a little bit, you know, that, you know, when you think you have very few options, you're liable to do something that's self-destructive or that doesn't work out in the long run. So even though time is short, taking a breather, sometimes going offline, you know, sometimes you can reach a breakthrough when you're not really pushing that hard against each other. It's interesting, too, that a lot of this tension is between Republicans in the legislature, too, over two different schools, which also leads to an interesting thing. I call it, when I used to referee karate tournaments, really call a point when you see it, whether you like the guy or not, whether you like their style, whether you like their teacher, whether you think their uniform's dorky or whatever. When someone scores a legitimate point, you should call it, you know, and I think I've given a point to the House for at least being skeptical about totally abolishing the income tax over time. And, you know, it's interesting. I think it's a good practice, though, to call a point with your opponent, with anyone, when they do something, call it, acknowledge it.
You find yourself on the other side of the House Republicans, Rick, more often than not, on some of these issues. But you're seeing them come back and doing things that you think protect low-income people, and you're giving them credit for that. Calling the point.
Right. And like there's some people who there's in the legislature that we oppose on things like SNAP, who really champion the Second Chance for Employment bill. And, you know, just people are complicated. Senator Carmichael was really embracing the income tax thing, which I think is a bad idea. But he also helped stop RFRA, which I think is a good thing. And so just call the point.
I think one of the things that we're dealing with here is something called anchoring. The House doesn't want to raise sales taxes, except they would allow some exemptions to go away to earn some extra money. The Senate is determined to raise the sales tax in order to have a large income tax break. And those two sides have been pretty much set for a couple months now. Instead of basically getting closer together, it seems like they're getting farther and farther apart. Every time they come back together for a special session and they send a bill to each other, it doesn't get closer. It gets farther away. And I think the theory there is anchoring. I am giving Rick and Lori two pieces of paper. I want you guys to quietly, without sharing, look at the number on the piece of paper.
Okay.
You memorize what that number is. Now I want you to estimate for me the number of countries in Africa and write that down on that piece of paper. Okay, have we written down our answers?
Yep.
Okay. There are 54 countries in Africa.
What? Are you kidding me?
Lori, what did you write?
I wrote 16.
Okay, and Rick, how many countries did you say there were?
25.
Okay. Now, I wrote two numbers on that piece of paper before you got it. One was higher than 54 and one was lower. All right, what was your number, Rick?
78.
And what was your number?
30.
It worked. Yay. I did not set this up. Lori got a lower number and she picked a lower number of countries. Rick got a much higher number, and he picked a higher number of countries. And even though I said the word anchoring and everything, I gave a lot away, you all still did it. In the case of the legislature, it might be the governor saying, I don't want to cut any money out of any program whatsoever. What you're doing is you're trying to anchor in someone's mind, like this is like one end of it. And then Senate might say, well, we want to eliminate all income taxes. They're anchoring on the other side. So is this going to work? Is this effective? I mean, obviously it works as a parlor trick, but what does this do in real life?
As you talk about this, I'm thinking about when my husband and I bought our first house, we wanted to offer a really low number, like $50,000 less than they were asking. And our realtor was very much like, you know, you cannot, you can't insult them. It has to be an offer that is reasonable.
And this goes back to something you've talked about, Rick. It's different when you're going to have to deal with people in the future. Like we're in West Virginia, we all have to live with each other.
Right. So there's one part of game theory that I think is really useful for people, and it's sort of the prisoner's dilemma, which is a imaginary situation where two people are arrested for a crime. They can't talk to each other. They don't know what the other person's saying, and they could either cooperate with each other by not saying anything, or one person could rat out the other one and get a lighter sentence, or they both could rat out each other and get a medium term sentence. And so, like, if you're only going to interact with people once, there's actually an incentive to be as exploitive as you can and get whatever you can. But if you're going to deal with the same people over and over and over again, then the incentive to cooperate goes up.
So it's West Virginia. We're all going to see each other in the supermarket. So therefore, well, what explains then what seems to be this budget showdown, this ratcheting up of tensions? These players, the House Republicans, the Senate Republicans, the governor, they're all going to have to work with each other in the future.
Well, the other thing that they're all going to have to do in the future is stand for reelection. And I think that that's where the element of fear comes in, particularly for Republicans, but not only for Republicans. Look, we're talking about raising taxes, right, by a pretty significant amount in total. And the problem is, you know, if you're a legislator, you're looking at what your next election campaign is going to look like and what your opponent is going to say about you.
Increasingly, too, there might be Republican primary opponents, right?
Exactly. And, you know, if they can say Delegate X voted to raise the sales tax and voted to raise the gas tax and hike the tolls, you know, that's powerful. And that's going to be a pretty unpopular message. And, you know, Democrats have that, too. And that's why, you know, the ideal solution is a package that gets broad support. And so it's very hard for one side to attack the other for raising your taxes if the vote is, you know, 90% to 10%.
There's still time for you to take part in the most important membership campaign in our station's history. We're on our way to raising $500,000 by June 30th with your help. Become a sustaining member or consider making an additional gift to protect West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Call 1-800-RADIO-87 or click the red donate button at wvpublic.org. Thanks. Well, let me talk about this then, another theory in social science about how people can get together and come to agreements on things, is making sure that you frame the issue using the other person's value frame instead of your own value frame. So in general, for example, conservative values might align with things like respect for authority and tradition, hard work, whereas liberal frames might circle around things like equality and taking care of one another. Rick, what's the frame that you would put, let's say, Medicaid expansion in that a conservative might listen to and say, oh, okay, that fits my worldview?
Well, I think what you typically happens when it comes to questions of public policy is you don't necessarily try to convert the hardcore opposition. You try to move the spectrum of allies. So if you can move someone who's actively against you to being passively against you, someone who's passively against you to being neutral, someone who's neutral, you move. It's about working the spectrum.
Well, exactly. And that starts with being able to realize what their arguments are and then frame your side in an argument that they'll listen to. Let me try one. Let me help you out. We need to have some form of basic health care in the country so that, you know, if we're ever attacked, that we have a basic level of health in this country, that we have the ability to recruit a military that actually works. One of the reasons why we have a school lunch program is because during World War II, they were recruiting all of these people and they realized that they were malnourished, and that malnourishment made them weaker soldiers. So if we want a strong country, strong military, we must have a strong healthcare program for everyone. There. I've just framed Medicaid expansion around a conservative set of values. I think that, by the way, the bill that the House passed on the budget is a really good example of this. The Republicans want some tax breaks and they want some cuts. The Democrats want to protect certain programs, and they want to make sure that if there are any tax breaks, that it goes to the people in the middle class and lower. And the House budget does this, right?
Right. Changing the tax treatment of Social Security benefits. We're one of the few number of states that actually tax those benefits, and they were going to take that tax away for people making, $100,000 and under, and then veterans benefits similarly. So you could go to your constituents and say, look, you know, we took away the tax on Social Security benefits, veterans benefits. We're helping retirees and veterans. That was the tax lowering that went on in that bill.
And we held the line on sales tax. We did not increase your sales tax.
One thing I think is another good way of looking at this is the analogy of the elephant and the rider, and that is most of us operate on automatic pilot most of the time. He calls that system one or the elephant. You know, we just sort of go by intuition. And he talks about we're like the emotional dog with a rational tail, too, is another way of looking at it. And the rational conscious part of us is like the little tiny rider on top of the elephant. The elephant is a lot stronger. The rider is really not in charge. He's more like the elephant's lawyer. And so what we often do when dealing with issues like this is argue with the rider. And he says it's more productive to talk to the elephant, which means, you know, relate to people as humans, you know, find what you have in common, establish some kind of rapport that way, and then deal with whatever issues you have to deal with. That's kind of what we've done here a little bit on the front porch. I think our elephants are fairly civil to each other.
Our donkeys, too.
You know, it's interesting, as someone who is trained as a lawyer, that's really the opposite of what you do in the law. I mean, it's a little bit different when you're talking about a jury, because you tend to be appealing more to emotion in that. But if you're arguing in front of just a judge or a panel of judges, to go in and say, well, you know, this makes me feel X, is not going to get you very far. And it really shouldn't, because that's, you know, the legal system that we have is based on things that are written down. And, you know, you should get the same result before any judge. It shouldn't matter whether. And of course, you know, it does sometimes.
Of course it does. It matters a lot. And so I would think that a good lawyer would have to, on one hand, you know, you have to be able to make your rational arguments, but then you have to be willing to change your arguments to suit the judges that you're going to be talking to or your audience, right?
Right. It's about the gloss that you put on it. But I guess the law wants to preserve at least the idea, the sense of itself as being driven by reason and logic and dispassionate arguments, and not so much by emotion. Of course, those are always, you know, they are underneath or a little bit over top.
Which is also one reason why it's a good strategy to always try to work something out before you go to court. In the same way, you know, like in a way, the law is a substitute for violence. So, like, when do you use violence? When do you go to court? You should always try to do whatever you can to work things out short of that, if at all possible. And that's kind of the elephant to relational thing. I think there's a growing movement among attorneys, not just for arbitration, but for mediation and negotiation.
Well, and I would be the first to say that the wonderful thing about West Virginia and Appalachian culture is that it's still a place where people know people as people. You do not go up to each other and necessarily say, hey, what do you do for a living? You know each other through a web of relationships. So usually the conversation is around who you know, where you're from, and who you know. And if you're in like a professional situation in, let's say, a bigger city, it's much more around your title, your job, what you do. But even in West Virginia, I think that lovely part of Appalachian culture is eroding a bit. You see it with this budget fight, and you see it on social media, which is really the worst possible way to talk to each other, because we're just talking at each other. It feels like, you know, people are making their polemics and shouting at each other and not having these conversations where you can say, well, what's the other side's best argument?
The thing that strikes me about social media is how little it's actually gauged at persuasion. It's almost like we're performing persuasion, but what we're really doing is talking to our little group, our core. I mean, that's kind of why I don't really use Facebook anymore. There was so much of it, I felt like people weren't even trying to persuade me. They were just signaling to each other, you know, yes, I'm part of this group. I was thinking about this morning. There are actually two friends that I have on Facebook who I don't think are doing that, who they post a lot of politics, and one's on the left and one's on the right. And they're really sincerely trying to persuade. And it's almost striking how odd that is. And the thing that those two people have in common is that they're both kind of socially clueless. And it's like they don't get the game. They don't get that we're not here to listen to each other. We're here to root for one side or another and pile on. And they're kind of these like, you know, innocents who are really think that they're persuading people. There should be more of that, but there just isn't. And I don't think there's going to be.
You know, I gotta say, I'm disturbed that we are creating this artificial divide in this country. We have enough divides to deal with in terms of class and race and all these things. And on top of it, we're dividing ourselves on social media and increasingly in real life into these different communities that don't talk to each other, that don't see each other. People move to different cities and states because the other side is predominant. And I just think that that's a bad road to go down. And yeah, I'm not sure what the answer is. I think it's more talk like this, what we're trying to do here.
Also, feeding trolls is a form of Christian charity when it comes to social media. Also, you know, one thing I think where groups on any political side screw up is they focus either on their own choir, the people that are on their side, or on jabbing at the opposition, neither of which are very useful. If you become totally engrossed in your own little group dynamic, it's a recipe for sectarian disaster. If you just, and, you know, the more you push people, they're going to push back. That's the way conflict works. You know, you pull someone, they want to pull away. It's a game of tit for tat. So people do have miraculous conversions, like Paul on the road to Tarsus, but it doesn't happen every day. And it usually happens as a result of a lot of unconscious tensions.
So my plea, and look, we've been doing this almost for 2 years now on the front porch. We made a decision that we would sacrifice some of our time in order to have conversations across these divides. We did it. I mean, we're in a small state. It's pretty easy to do, and we just made it happen. And I would like to think that maybe West Virginia could resist the sort of national trend on this and be able to have its political leaders, its business community, its activists to be able to still talk to each other as people. We don't have to go down the path everyone else has gone down. It just takes leadership.
So in lieu of a Bible quote, I'm thinking of a couple things come to me. One's from the Tao Te Ching, and the other's from a saying of the Buddha. In the Tao Te Ching, somewhere it says, arguments don't convince, which is they really don't convince your hardcore opponent. They might move other people. And the other is, the Buddha said, an exponent of the Dharma does not quarrel with anyone in the world.
What? Say that one slower.
An exponent of the Dharma, of the teaching, does not quarrel with anyone in the world.
What do they do instead?
Well, they deal with their own stuff, or they, you know, jabbing away at your hardcore opponent is not going to convert them, not going to convince them. So find other more productive ways. In general, yelling at people doesn't work.
You know what? I will start this right now. I love the Charleston Gazette Mail. Read it every day. Huge supporter. But you know what they have in there that I think they just need to get rid of? It's their, what they call the reader's voice or the reader's vent or whatever it is. Do you read that thing? People anonymously calling in. It's worse than Facebook. People anonymously call in, and basically half of them are liberals are stupid, conservatives are stupid, and the other half are kind of like, gee, I wish they'd put a Red Lobster in St. Albans.
You are such an elitist, Scott. This is the voice of the people, the one voice of the people, and this is the one section of the paper that you want to eliminate. I like it. I like the things that are like the Red Lobster stuff. I mean, there's always some sort of nugget or some, you know, some kind of gossipy thing that tickles me. But yeah, I mean, the political stuff is usually just ranting. And really, if you want to do that, you should write a letter to the editor, right? That you have a
put
section.
Put your name on it.
Right.
I agree. I would like to take out all the political stuff. I remember they had one of these in Lincoln County when I lived there. And it was anonymous. I'm putting air quotes around anonymous because people would say things like, I'm not going to say who it is, but the person who lives in the trailer on Branch Lick Road who has all the dogs and the trash in the yard, they better clean it up.
So in defense of the vent line, my wife sometimes will cut out and put on our refrigerator some of the gems. And one of our all-time favorites is, to the person who sold me a Ford F-150 in the parking lot of Walmart, you are not a Christian.
But it sounds like they're good in the art of persuasion.
See, that's also like game theory. That person wasn't going to have to interact with the same person over and over again, so they could stick him with the Ford F-150.
See? Oh my goodness. Who buys a Ford F-150 in the parking lot of the Walmart?
They should have used wvcarfinder.com.
They should have used the Gazette Mail's wvcarfinder.com. All right. Well, hey, thanks for listening. And if you have an argument to make with us, let us know on Twitter, which we do still monitor despite the fact that it's evil, at WV Pundet, at El Cabrero, and at Radio Finn. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director here with Lori Lynn and Rick Wilson. Thanks for listening.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear a word they're saying.